and welcome to another edition of the Ship Energy Podcast. I'm Leslie Banks-Hughes, and today I'm going to be talking to a very well-known and proactive leader in the maritime industry, Pia Melling. Pia has had an extensive career in shipping, and the imperatives of sustainability and decarbonisation have informed and underpinned her job choices, including working on good practice in ship recycling and on zero-emission autonomous shipping. In March this year, she left Greig Green, where she was managing director, and she's now leading the team at Evigo, which is the green services offshoot of the ship management company OSM Tome. One of the largest global ship managers, OSM Tome handles the operations and crewing of around 1,000 vessels across a range of segments. And when it launched its Evigo division in late 2024, one of its mission statements was, and I quote, to tackle environmental targets head on. So a very warm welcome to the podcast, Pia.
Thank you.
I hope that we're going to have enough time to touch on a range of topics today, but maybe to start off, can you perhaps talk in a little more detail about why Evigo was born, what kind of business culture or values you're hoping to inculcate in this new venture, and of course, why did you decide to take on the job as MD?
I sure will. Thank you for having me here, by the way. And Evigo, we would really like to deliver impactful, measurable results for our customers. We are coupling the, you would say, the deep and technical knowledge of the OSM Tome teams with partnerships, with innovation, with new ways of thinking to bring about change to our customers, to lead them into this green future with certainty, because it's a challenge these days to stay both compliant and competitive for ship owners, as you know. There's some clear knowledge gaps, both on shore and on board ships, when it comes to all the new technologies and the new fuels that will be taken into use. And it can be very demanding for each individual small and medium-sized ship owner to navigate all these choices that they have and actually make informed decisions on what suits their ships and their trade and their risk appetite. So we believe that we could pool this knowledge through what we already have in OSM Tome, but also through some partnerships and collaborations, and that we can give benefits of scale to our customers, not only in on compliance, but of course also exceeding compliance and pushing towards a low emissions future. And you asked, why did I take the job? Well, as you mentioned, the last 7 years or so, I've been working on very important topics, but very niche topics, I would say, like sustainable ship recycling and autonomous zero-emission ships. And I now feel an urge to make an impact on the day-to-day operation of the sailing world fleet, because one thing is what we do with new buildings and also what we do at the end of life with ships. But what about all the vessels out there that are sailing and that are and that have potential to cut emissions? So OSM Tome is, in my view, of the ship managers out there, the most transparent and people-first company. They really invest in their crew and in their employees. And as we are also now a new and important part of OSM Tome in Evigo, I think that we are set up to succeed with the support that we're getting from the company, and I really believe that we can accelerate this transformation of the shipping industry from this position, and that's my personal goal also, to contribute to that. And you know, when I retire, that I can look back and say that I did something to help the transition.
Okay, so the Pia Melling legacy.
Yeah, aren't you feeling the same, that you want to leave something behind?
It would be nice, it definitely would be, yes. Yeah, and decarbonisation is a good thing to have a legacy within, certainly. I mean, you've touched on loads of topics there that, you know, we'll come back to in a moment, but, you know, I think it'd be fair to say that sort of in meeting global and regional decarbonisation targets, in many ways it's redefined or recalibrated the working relationship between a lot of shipping stakeholders. So I just wonder if you can maybe explain what the impact of the energy transition is or is having on the work of a ship manager and also its relationship with ship owners.
Yes, I think actually this energy transition and also all the new regulations is the good thing about it. It's really helping us, forcing us to collaborate closer within this value chain. So we as ship managers, of course, we play an instrumental role since we know everything that's happening on the day-to-day operation of the ships. And we can definitely also see the impact of new technologies on the crew and what will be required to make sure that they can really utilize the new technologies and the new fuels safely, right? So as you mentioned, we have close to 2,000 vessels in the Western Tom. We also have a pool of almost 30,000 seafarers that we draw from and around 2,000 people on shore. So of course we can play a role in adding competency to the individual ship owners when it comes to not only the everyday performance management of the ships, but also what kind of fuel-saving technologies are out there that can be retrofitted on the vessels and how do they work in practice. Because one thing is the theoretical idea on what you could put on board and how much fuel it can save. The other part is the real-life experience that we can see firsthand. So I think that, again, the scale that we have as ship managers across a number of vessel types, trades, different owners with different operation challenges, I think we can draw learnings from that, condense it, and offer it to our customers through a quicker way for them to learn and to not make the same mistakes as other people have done, right? So that we can actually not reinvent the wheel every time we're trying something new. But we have to work much closer with the ship owners. And I would say that we are becoming maybe more strategically important for them, not just a commodity where only price or lowest cost is the measure, right? So we are more helping them shape their strategies and we're doing it together. So I think in many ways it's a good opportunity and it's a good time, I think, for me also to enter the ship management industry as such, because I believe we can have a more impactful position going forward.
I mean, you've touched on there that sort of ship owner, ship manager working relationship, which is collaboration. So let's drill down maybe a little bit more into what collaboration actually means in terms of shipping's decarbonisation. I mean, I think sort of, you know, at the outset, or maybe 4 or 5 years ago, you know, that was the buzzword. That was what we were told was going to be needed to sort of really catalyse the energy transition in shipping. And, you know, sort of thinking now we've got many projects on the go, whether it be, you know, decarbonisation knowledge hubs or the green shipping corridors. But I just wonder, are these sort of initiatives really advancing the aims of decarbonisation at sufficient pace? Or do you think sort of perhaps they allow, you know, just a tiny element of maybe greenwashing and box ticking to creep in?
I wouldn't call it greenwashing, but I would say that there's lots of good intentions. You know, people have signed up for all these clusters, as you mentioned. There's, of course, a lot of academia, jumping on assisting the industry as well with solutions. There's research funding from governments, from the EU and so on. And it's a good start, but of course signing an MOU or like a charter of partnership is not the collaboration itself. And it has to start from there. And I see that there's kind of lacking some tangible results maybe of all these collaborations and clusters. So I think that would be important going forward because people are also getting, you know, a certain fatigue when it comes to all sorts of clusters and getting to zero coalitions they should sign up for, right? And to navigate also which one are actually affected. I think there has to be more tangible proof that it leads to something more than knowledge transfer, but actually solutions and changes. And also I believe that shipping executives should engage more with the regulators, and I'm happy to see more CEOs, for example, Lasse Kristoffersen from Wallenius Wilhelmsen and Andreas Engel from Höegh Autoliners. They're competitors, but they are collaborating to push the regulators, especially the EU, to understand more about shipping and you know, what will actually work for us as an industry. So that's a good development, I think, that we interact more with the regulators. And also, of course, collaborating among ship owners is one thing. But of course, it is in the value chain if you collaborate with the makers of equipment, with the service providers, and with the charters and cargo owners. That's where you will find real progress. But it's super challenging. to collaborate like this. And of course, we haven't maybe understood what it takes to collaborate in real life, because it takes time, it takes trust. You maybe have to give up something, right? It's not always a win-win-win. And maybe even you need a new ways of aligning incentives or financial contracts. And it's difficult to get this really going. And unless you have aligned financial incentives to make the change, it will not happen. So I think we have to look more at the commercial side and not just the technical side of what's possible.
Indeed. And, you know, and as you intimated, obviously, collaboration implies information sharing, and that can be commercial information. So do you think, when it actually, in practice, some of the shipping community might find that quite hard to just to sort of, give a little bit of knowledge about themselves to other partners?
Yeah, and I have a background from trading ships myself, and of course information was key to everything. You would have more information than other people, and then you would have an advantage trading position. So sharing information is not in our DNA as shipping players, and that takes a bit of time to overcome that fear of sharing and being transparent and understanding that it's only when we have to start sharing data that we can improve. It's a cultural hinder, I think, for us as an industry that we need to overcome.
And as you mentioned, OSM Tome, it sort of works across a range of vessel segments. And, I know you haven't been very long in the job, but are you already beginning to see any differences in the way that these segments may be putting together and implementing their decarbonisation strategies?
Yes, of course. Those segments that are more mature when it comes to decarbonisation planning and actions, of course, are those that operate their own vessels or pay for their own fuel, or who have long-term contracts with charters and cargo owners. So they can actually have this split of both the cost and the benefits of either greener fuels or retrofitting vessels to be more energy efficient. So as you know, container vessels and ro-ro vessels are normally leading these transitions, also because they have consumer exposure to consumer markets, and consumers tend to be more concerned with pollution. But of course, we also see that a big difference between the ship owners that have a high EU exposure, that are trading a lot in the EU, they are they're looking into the scenarios for the future, and they're planning for more and more stringent cost of emissions. So they are also more inclined to move forward with decarbonization plans, as I see it.
And you mentioned earlier that there are thousands of vessels on the water. We've got the global fleet as it is, and not all those vessels are by any means near the end of their life cycle. So their GHG emissions profiles do have to be addressed. So how's Evigo approaching this challenge in terms of things like adopting new technologies or going down the retrofit route, etc.?
Yes, we are a big believer in the potential of, optimizing the current fleet. So not only through voyage optimization, where still a lot can be done in terms of proper coating, of course, and hull cleaning, timely hull cleaning and things like this. But we also help our customers, not only the existing vessels that we have at ship management, but also other third parties, on studying what would make sense for them in terms of retrofitting anything from a new propeller to a boss cap fin to air lubrication to sails, various options there. What we could do, like an economical and technical feasibility analysis, where we see what makes sense technically, but also what gives an attractive payback time in fuel savings. And then we are offering to do turnkey projects to help them. If the customer does not have that organization in-house, we can procure the equipment at a discount. We can help choose the right shipyard. We could oversee the installation, and we could measure the effect of retrofitting. So we could take a full project on. We are not just advisors and data providers, but also a project partner for these projects. And we see a lot more interest. We see a lot of potential for the current fleet to have a longer life, to have a better CII rating and lower penalties when trading in the EU. And there seems to be an increasing appetite for this.
And I mean, we know that the really big ship owners have the sort of financial heft to do all this innovation and vessel efficiency and optimize their vessels, their current sailing vessels. But I mean, how are you finding that the smaller mid-sized ship owners are looking at the situation? You know, do they know where to go for this sort of knowledge and guidance?
I think they a lot of them follow the big ones, of course. You see, whenever Maersk or somebody is making a choice, and you try and follow. But many adopt a bit of a wait-and-see approach because it doesn't feel urgent. There's other more urgent pressing issues with their trade there today. And of course, they believe that the longer they wait, the better the choices in terms of technology and the lower the prices, which is also often the case. But there could also be opportunities there to split this with a charter, and that's where we see the big volume going forward. That if you are either responsible for your own fuel cost, so you immediately get the savings, or you can actually make an agreement with your charter on a long-term agreement on retrofitting these ships, then it can be much more feasible. And of course, there's financing. As well, most ship owners still have money in this market, but some are struggling, of course. And then that can be to get some help on the green financing, the transition loans that banks are offering, things like that, sustainability-linked financing with better terms. That can also be a catalyst.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, are you seeing that charterers are increasingly willing to sort of shoulder some of that financial burden?
Some of them are, yes, not all, but it is, I would say it's increasing. Of course, this is part of, especially for EU-based charters, that again, that have to report all their emissions. This is part of their, not their primary scope, which is their production of goods, but of course, it's part of their scope 3 emissions. And for many of them, they have set zero emission targets, and they have to also work on the shipping side. It's still secondary to their own production, but we're starting to see the big charters taking more responsibility, I would say. So if we can also be a catalyst in smart contracts, and smart ways of sharing the cost and the benefit of these retrofits, I think that can also help the discussion.
And maybe switching now from technology to sort of, the uptake of alternative fuels. Another buzzword we're hearing, or buzz phrase, is demand signals. So, ship owners, they're not going to order new ships until they're confident about the volumes of new fuels they can secure. And, in turn, energy producers won't take final investment decisions on production facilities until they get those firm, long-term offtake agreements from the owners. So, I mean, how can this sort of standoff be resolved, do you think?
Well, I wish I knew, because then I could fix it. No, of course. I mean, in the optimal world, we could agree on what fuel types fits what kind of vessel types and what trades. And then we could all, as an industry, we could go for a few selected options and we could invest in that. But of course, that's not realistic. We will never agree on that. And I don't blame the ship owners with all the regulatory uncertainty that we will come back to, right? What is actually a zero emission fuel or a close to zero emission fuel? What is the definition? Where will it be available? What will be the cost? It's almost impossible for them to make this choice at this point. But maybe there could be, another catalyst for change these days, that all the geopolitical uncertainty, leading actually the national energy security issues are becoming a lot more evident. And maybe there could be more push from a national responsibility within many countries to invest and secure new energy types for all transportation modes going forward, and of course also for the countries as such. Perhaps we could be seeing something developing there, I hope so. For example, in Norway, the electricity, of course, is a state-owned company that makes sure that we have enough electricity and looks into the trading balance of electricity with Europe and so on. And you could consider there could be setups similar like that for other types of energy that is needed going forward. Otherwise, I guess it's, again, the sharing of risk and cost that has to be enabled through either regulation, like IMO is trying to do, or before then, between the commercial parties where it makes sense.
Okay, and we have to get to regulation, so we might as well bite the bullet and do it now. So I just want to sort of, let's have a look at EU regulation, EU measures that have come into play. So obviously we've got the emissions trading system, we've got fuel EU maritime. You know, how are you, I know we're sort of early days really in terms of how they're actually working, but you know, how onerous and complicated do you think compliance is with these regulations? And, you know, given that they're sort of meant to accelerate or drive forwards decarbonisation, do you think they really do have the bite to be able to achieve those aims?
It's good that EU is ambitious and leading the way, but I find that most of the EU regulation is too complex and it seems not to have been thought through enough or tested enough before implemented. So one example is, you know, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. That is not for shipping, it's for all industries, but it hit a lot of big shipping companies in Europe. And it was so detailed, and it was maybe too soon that it was so detailed and very costly. Because most of that money actually went to the big consultancy companies and the audit firms, right, who assisted with it. And so time, money, and energy and resources goes into just reporting details and details and details instead of actually working on solutions to improve. So it's a start, but of course, EU has also simplified this now with the omnibus package, delaying it, you know, making the threshold higher. As from ETS and Fuel EU, that has been implemented and most likely will not change. But there are some teething problems there as well. For EU ETS, you know, there's been issues with delays in verification from class. It's very manual work back and forth with the data quality and the data gathering and reporting. There's been software issues and, of course, the local authorities that are delegated with this responsibility, they have not been super prepared either. So I would say that intentions are good, but it leads to too much bureaucracy and it leads to too much work on a very detailed level that doesn't really bring about the change. So I would have hoped for a more simplified and more thought through regulation in a way. And, you know, for Fuel EU, of course, we, as a document of compliance holder or ISM company, we are responsible. But we make no decisions on the fuel. Even the ship owner rarely makes that decision. It's the charterer. So, of course, we will do the reporting, we'll get all the data, and we'll advise our owners as good as we can. But there's something here that is, you know, unnecessarily complex that the EU might not understand, you know, the extent of the complexity of our shipping industry.
Well, I guess the sort of the genie's out of the bottle, isn't it? So we'll have to just see how it works in practice, how it sort of spools out, and you know, as I say, maybe it will be refined a little bit down the road or whatever. But I mean, obviously we've got the EU regs, and now, surprise, surprise, we've got the decisions that came out of MEPC 83. And I just wondered, how surprised were you that the proposal for a standalone levy sort of really dropped from the agenda? It didn't really feature, did it, during that week of discussions?
No, I was sorry to hear that. And now we are left with a compromise that is also unnecessarily complicated and maybe doesn't bite as much as it could. But of course, I'm on the positive side. There was an agreement reached, at least, despite, you know, the very drama from the US, the threatening of retaliation and all this. And I'm also very positive to see that countries like China, Brazil, and India actually voted in favor of this proposal. So, I mean, there are big, important countries moving alongside, you might say, EU in this decarbonization effort. So that's good. It's also good that the life cycle emissions of fuels are considered here, so that this actually not just moving the pollution somewhere else. The pooling options that will be offered here, similar to Fuel EU, I believe that's quite interesting because that could stimulate market forces more creativity in terms of, you know, over-compliance trading. I think that's a good thing about this proposal, that perhaps that could boost the case for a more sustainable fuel production earlier, because some companies will see it, you know, as a trading opportunity to secure over compliance and then sell it, you know, more expensive later. So perhaps that could help, although it is kind of unnecessarily complicated. And of course, the funds that is raised here could be considerable and could also help this transition. But of course, on the negative side, it's not adopted. It has to be a second vote, as you know. Most people believe the two-thirds majority will be secured, but also a lot of people are just waiting to see. And anyway, it's not coming into force before 2028, really. It's not really pushing a lot in terms of doing something today, but I think as ship owners and traders and charters and, you know, fuel production companies are starting to plan for scenarios, looking at these gradually increasing CO2 costs, also from IMO, is actually helping the investment case, of course. So hopefully it will come through, hopefully it can be simplified, and of course that the actual price of polluting is increased quickly, because it has to bite, basically, to really make a big difference.
Yes. And I wonder, in some respects, do you think sort of, you know, I know we didn't get sort of the consensus probably that we'd hoped for, but it's sort of, so many people have sort of, you know, got the ambition, have said it has to be a global regulation that applies to everybody. So do you think the fact that, you know, there was a vote, we've got somewhere, we've moved the dial a little bit, we've kind of got over almost a psychological barrier, you know, we've moved forward on that global front?
I think you can see it as that at least IMO were able to agree on something, right? And we're at the majority that could well be repeated in October, and it gives us some hope that we are able to move forward. I agree, even though it's supposed to compromise. And I think if you are starting to look at simplifying the EU regulation and maybe aligning the EU regulation with the global regulation at some point, then it can really be powerful. And because, of course, I believe in a level playing field globally. I think you had to go first, but it's not sustainable that we will have a totally separate regulation for the EU in the future. And I guess that EU, when they see that the IMO regulation is strict enough, they will hopefully align.
Hopefully. I think that harmonisation, I think probably, fine words, but how that would be tremendously difficult in practice, won't it?
It will. But one could see the EU regulation as a transition regulation until the rest of the world are ready to jump on board, and that you somehow find the best of all measures and implement it. But I think the overall direction is it's going to be more costly to pollute. You have to start planning. You have to run some scenarios with various penalties for fossil fuel, and you have to start thinking about also the opportunities, especially when it comes to pooling, that it can actually incentivize overperformance on some vessels that could be worthwhile to sell to others later. I think that's for me quite interesting development.
Okay. So let's shift the perspective a little bit and sort of, you know, look at what's happening on the ground or on the water rather, and sort of, you know, we already know that there's a big crew and officer shortage on conventionally fueled shipping coming down the line, not very far away at all. And we're also edging closer to that key decarbonisation date of 2030. So I just wonder how your company is working to address the challenge of creating and retaining a workforce which has the skills to use those new fuels and technologies.
Oh, this is very, very close to our heart at OSM Dong. We're really working with seafarer welfare and also a culture of continuous learning and improvement. There's some interesting advanced training techniques, you know, that for like VR simulations or gamification that we can start adopting to make it easier for our crew to really follow in an interesting way for them all the developments with confidence. And we also value the physical and psychological well-being of our seafarers very, very high. You know, we have this Nordic medical clinic in the Philippines that offers free healthcare not only to the crew but also to their extended family. We have telemedicine and mental support also, and religious support for the seafarers. And we really have invested also in healthy and good food on board our ships, which is also important. So I would say that we try to be very mindful that the seafarers are the core asset that we have, and it's, it has to be treated like the very, very valuable resource they are. We listen to them, we interact with them, and we want to be the preferred employer. I'm also quite, you know, in the day-to-day that we're working now with the crew on reporting all the data that is required for EU ETS and fuel EU, and I see that they're struggling, you know, with the manual burden of reporting. There's a lot of talk about artificial intelligence, which is great if you have good solid data, but we have to start with the data gathering, and we have to help our seafarers to not have to report that much manually and to kind of take away the burden of correcting data while they should be doing their job on board on other topics. So for me, that is, it's interesting to work with, you know, big data models and AI, but you have to fix the basics first. So that is my focus, to really try and remove the double entries, the manual processes on board, and assist as much as possible to make that easy.
And do you think, you know, a lot of people say, you know, not very many young people these days want to go away for huge long periods at sea, you know, away from family, you know, they can get jobs that pay just as well, you know, on land. I mean, do you think that sort of shipping's energy transition offers really exciting prospects for a sort of a really new and different career at sea than we've seen in the past?
Well, I think definitely it could. Since the crew is more instrumental than ever, maybe in making this transition successful, they have to be involved much more in the decision making, and we have to make it a human centric design. You know, whatever technology we put on board, and of course also the new fuels, they have to be considering the human element, and they could maybe have a more influential role, I would think, and also feel more empowered, and that they are they're really part of changing this industry. It's something you shouldn't, you know, undervalue, that it's that need to feel that you're doing something important. It can really unleash good results. And young people, back to Norway, of course not typical of the world maybe, but we see a lot more young people now applying for education, maritime education, also for seagoing educations, because we've also been very good at having, you know, young ambassadors on TikTok and all sorts of social media posting from their day-to-day job, both the men and women, and maybe seeing the kind of adventure that they also get. Of course, they're away, but they get to travel the world and see amazing places, and it can be a great team on board, and they can learn so much. So I think if you open up more, show this to the young generation, even to like teenagers in school, show them how important our industry is and how many different jobs we can have, both on board and on shore, we could perhaps draw more talent to our industry.
And maybe if you could just finally sort of circle back to the beginning of the conversation, you know, obviously you've had a lot of leadership roles in the industry. So I just wonder if from where you're sitting, if you think the sort of the definitional scope of leadership is changing due to shipping's energy transition. I mean, are you yourself, you know, reevaluating your role as a leader?
I would say that it is, you know, because if you want a culture of sustainability, it has to start at the top, but not only setting goals and putting it on your website, right? But actually, leadership is what you do every day and what you say, the words you use and the choices you make. And you have to be very mindful that you need to not have all the answers, or you don't have all the answers. You can't just look in the mirror and find the solution to our problems, right? So we have to have a more, I would say, inclusive culture where also young people and people with different non-technical backgrounds are heard, that their different views are really considered, so that we're kind of coupling this, I would say, call it the domain knowledge that experienced people have in our industry with all these young talents that we are so lucky to have also in our industry. And we have to be super open-minded and curious, and we must dare to fail and have a culture, I think, where failing or doing mistakes is okay. Because if we don't innovate or try something new, we will also not progress. So I feel like actually I've been working in shipping my whole life, and it's now is the more fun period, because I think all CEOs of shipping companies realize they don't have all the answers and they need, you know, help from the whole organization, and you need to mobilize the whole organization. So it's actually a more like a coaching leadership, I would say, than the know-it-all leader that is developing, which is a lot more fun for everybody involved.
Excellent. So look forward to hearing how your work at Evergo turns out, and maybe we can catch up in a few months and see what's afoot. But today, thank you so much, Peter. Really interesting conversation. Glad you could join us on the Ship Energy podcast.
Thank you so much. Nice to meet you.